This interview with Douglas Harding was conducted by Barbara Rose Schuller in 1992 for KAZU Radio in Monterey, California.
And good evening to you, and welcome to Discovery. My name is Barbara Rose Schuller, and my guest is Douglas Harding, an Englishman who is here in this area to speak, among other things, about the fine art of living free from stress. He's a speaker, an architect, author, and teacher. Welcome, Douglas.
Welcome. Welcome to you, if I may say that.
You certainly may.
Welcome to you in my space. Yes.
You've got some very provocative titles for your books, and I think I'm going to share them first off and then maybe ask you to talk about them. On Having No Head is one. All of these are published by Penguin Arcana. Zen and the Rediscovery of the Obvious, that's all one book. The Little Book of Life and Death, Head Off Stress, and a novel, The Trial of the Man Who Said He Was God. Wonderful titles.
Provocative, I think.
Very provocative. Let's start with number four, the novel that hasn't come out yet, The Trial of the Man Who Said He Was God. Who is this man, and why did he say he was God?
Well, it's a blasphemy trial. In the year 2003, it's, I suppose, almost like science fiction in a way. And here's this chap who says that nearer to him than all else, at the very center of his life, is the origin of the world, is the indwelling spirit, reality, God, many names, could be Buddha nature, could be Kingdom of Heaven or whatever. And that is central in his life. And that he himself is very real as a person, as a man, but that man is peripheral to that center. And so the human part of him is not central. The human part is there. And for instance, and in particular, what he sees in the mirror is his human face and human personality. And that's what other people pick up. It's out there. It's about a meter or two away from the center. And that's where he keeps his humanity. And that is on show for other people. They're receiving it. That's where they hold their cameras to photograph him. That's where he finds that guy, in my case, Douglas, why he's there in the mirror. And this man who's on trial for blasphemy is saying that who he really is, this indwelling deity or reality, spirit, essence, that is who he really is, and that's the center of his life. And the whole art of life is to go there, stay there, because you never came out of it anyway. It's where you belong. It's home. And he says that this is deeply traditional, and it's what all the great religions are saying at the very heart of the heart of the heart of them. And he's saying that those people who are trying him for blasphemy in the year 2003, why, they are the blasphemers, because what they're doing is to put the guy in the mirror, they see in the mirror, they turn that person around and bring him forward and put that person at the center of their world. And this is blasphemy, because the center of your world and the world of everyone, the center of the being, of the right center where we are, is in fact the reality we come from, our source. So that's what the trial is about, and it's what the first book is about, On Having No Head, you see. And instead of a head here, a meatball, which I'm supposed to be looking out of, why, when I look here, you see, I'm looking at you, Barbara, now, and I don't find anything in your way. I find the meatball is non-existent here, and I'm spaced for Barbara, which is a great improvement, I can say, on what people told me is here.
Who is putting him on trial? Where is this taking place?
Well,
in 2003.
Well, it's I don't tell you where it's taking place, but I guess it's Great Britain somewhere.
Well, aren't we enlightened enough now, and hopefully will be in 2003, not to be putting people on trial for discovering their own divinity?
Well, you see, the issue of blasphemy is a very important one. Some people have said it's the great issue of the last part of the century. I mean, Salman Rushdie, you see, had been under threat of annihilation, a threat of being polished off.
Still is, according to the news. Yeah, I saw something in the paper today.
Still is. And there is a great deal of, in the world, I mean, no doubt, not so much in this country or in Great Britain, but in the world, I mean, this is a very live issue, and people are being jailed and even polished off, even executed now on account of this, of alleged blasphemy. So it is a very real issue. But the point is not really, the book is not to put in a plea for tolerance and liberal, open view about these things. It is not the point. The point is that this trial taking place in the future, it's an account of the trial, you see. This trial is a peg on which to hang the doctrine, the teaching, the experience, which my whole life is about, which is seeing who you really, really are at centre. And when he defends himself against 27 witnesses, you see, he comes out what he is saying, and he's answering the people who say he's talking nonsense. So I think it's an excellent peg on which to hang what I have to say.
Well, let's go back to the first book on having no head, and maybe explore through that some of what you're all about.
I think that's a good idea, Barbara. So what would you like me to do? Tell you what it's all about?
Well, I certainly want you to tell me what it's all about, but maybe what we should do is go back a little further and find out how you found out about what it's all about.
Well, that's a good
question. As in, who are you, and what is your experience?
Yes, well, that's a good starting point, isn't it? Well, I'm English. I'm 83, they tell me, and somewhat long in the tooth, if I had any to be long in. And I was an architect, but all my life, since youth, really, my passion has not been architecture at all. I earn my living at it, but my passion is to find out who I really, really, really am. The issue of my identity has been what makes me tick all along. I find it absolutely fascinating, and there are many reasons why I think this is the great issue of my life and should be of other people's lives, our true identity. The reasons I have, which you might like me to mention, for looking at this rather than being nose to the grindstone doing architecture. I earn my living at architecture, but this is my passion. Who am I? Who is this architect? And my reasons for looking into this matter were that I was such a terrible mess. I mean, as a young man, I really was incredibly shy, uptight, stressed, and socially very badly adjusted, had lots of problems like that. So that was a reason for looking to see, find the cure for this condition. And the great religious traditions have said the cure is central in my life. The cure of my problem is to see, Barbara, who has the problem. The cure of my problem, I don't care what the problem is to see who has the problem. And so...
that's a tricky one, isn't it?
I had terrible problems, and I had to see, therefore, who has the problem. But my main reason, apart from being a mess, which is a good reason, my main reason, I think...
It's a good starting place.
Well, my main reason was not that, really. My main reason was gratitude and surprise at having happened. You see, I think people...
At having happened at all.
And haven't happened at all. Well, it needn't have happened, you see. But I'm so pleased to have happened. And I think it's a miserable, horrible chicken-hearted thing to go through life, never asking who is going through life, and taking everybody's word, Barbara, but my own word. Look, I've got inside information which is denied to everyone, because nobody can come here and be where I am any more than anyone can go where you are and be you.
Yes.
And here I have information about who I am, first-hand information. And I find, when I really look here and dare to be my own authority and look at where I'm coming from, I find I'm exactly the opposite, but exactly the opposite of what I've been advertised to be, or what people tell me I am, or what language tells me I am. I find I'm the exact opposite. And my troubles, my stress, my agony, my anguish came very largely, I think, I'm sure, from lying about who I am, of taking everybody's word for what I am, and not daring to have a look for myself. And nobody can tell me what it's like here but me, because nobody is any. Everybody is too far away. They're about a foot, at least a foot or two away, aren't they? A meter away. And I have inside information. Then when I dare to look here, which I did and do, I find that everything is the exact opposite of what I had supposed and what society tells me.
And you suggest that language gets in our way of.
Yes, well,
this.
Let me give you an example of this. An absolutely hot stop press instance now, see, straight from the shoulder, so to say. Well, here in front of me is my new friend, who I met 10 minutes ago, called Barbara. And there she is. And here, in front of this mic here, is someone taking Barbara in receipt of Barbara, you see. Well, I find that society and language tell me that Barbara and I are in a symmetrical relationship and face to face, and that there's something here called a head, a face, a meatball, or I call it, and there's something here in receipt of her, and we are in a symmetrical relationship and is face-to-face situation. And I find this absolute, utter and total nonsense, and that I am busted wide open for Barbara at this time, and there's nothing in Barbara's way. And we are not face-to-face. There is face there, Barbara's face, and Douglas's absence of face here,
yeah,
which is in receipt of her. And so I have nothing, thank God, to keep Barbara out with, and I have, the only face I have at this time is a charming lady's face, about half a century younger than Douglas's face, when I see Douglas's face in the mirror. I am busted wide open for you. And it's true. And Barbara, if you say, well, Douglas, you're a crazy man, of course there's something here, but you can't see it. I swear to you there's nothing here. And Barbara, if you don't...
There's nothing here either, is there?
Well, for you to say. Well, you see, if you say, Douglas, you're a crazy man, there is something here, I say, all right, Barbara, come and see. And you see, if you were to come up to me now, I suppose we're about 4'6" apart, aren't we, 5 feet apart. Mm-hmm. And if you want to take a picture of Douglas, why, you would take it there. And then you get top half of him, probably. Now, you came halfway, a couple of feet. You would get his face, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And then you came here to 6 inches of your camera, you would get a picture of his nose or an eye or lips. And then you would have to start putting sophisticated lenses on, or exchange your optical microscope for electron microscope. And then your pictures, but pictures, would be of tissues, of cells, molecules, atoms. Well, atoms are nearly all empty space.
That's right.
And you come in leaving even atoms behind. There are particles, and God knows what they are, or even where they are, or even when they are. I mean, they're so absent, aren't they? But I complete the story, and I say I've gone all the way up to this place, and I've lost Douglas. And instead, I've lost a Douglas decaying old 83-year-old stale meatball, and I have now there in front of me a much younger and more, I almost said more delicious, all served up on your shoulders, you see. And I find it hilarious. I find it lubricates personal relationships, and it's an instance of many, many things, only one instance of the way society and language con us into denying who we really, really, really are. And when I look here and see who I really, really am as I'm doing at this moment, I am aware capacity. I'm space, which is infinite space, every which way, for it's awake space and unbounded space for the world at its time, Barbara, representing the world, for Barbara to happen in. And I find this delightful. It removes fear from my life. It removes stress, and I just enjoy life this way.
What a wonderful perspective.
But you can see it's true, isn't it?
Yes, quite.
And we're trading faces, aren't we?
Yes, it's wonderful.
Well, it is wonderful. It really is wonderful. Yes, we're trading faces. You see, the thing is, this is very important, Barbara. We are built not for confrontation. We are built for loving. Now, I'm not talking about the feeling of love. I'm talking about the setup in which love is possible, or in which love flourishes. And I say, in the real world, when we dare to have a look and question language and social conditioning, in the real world, we are incredibly blessed, and we are built for loving. We are built open for one another. And society runs on the face-to-face model of confrontation. In all languages, it's face-to-face. Visage à visage, face à face. In all languages, it's a symmetry. And this is a lie. It's not true. It's true of other people. You see two other people, they're face-to-face. But it's never true of oneself, vis-à-vis someone over there. So it's just a totally different way of life. But there's only one instance of the difference between who I find myself to be here and who my language and society and parents and teachers, bless their hearts, told me was here. So what I do in all these books and in all my meetings with people is to go around and I say, dare to look for yourself at what you're looking out of, and you will find that you are this immense, immortal, imperishable, awake capacity for the world. And this is the heart of all the great religions.
Yes. Douglas, let's talk about more lies. Tell me some more lies.
Yes, I'll tell you another lie. Jeff and I drove here from San Francisco. From Santa Cruz, actually. Did we move, or did the country move? The question is, if we look, which moved, the country or the car? And you see, when we're very, very little, we sit in a car and we tell the truth. And the telegraph poles go rushing by, and the buildings turn, and the scene is a ballet, isn't it? The whole scene dances, and this is the truth. And then we grow up, and we set it up differently, and our story is that the world grinds to a halt, and we move along the freeway. Well, what happens, Barbara, to that motion? All the dance of the world, all that motion, what happens to it? I say it comes in here, and I lose my inner tranquility. Now I say, now let me tell the truth, restore the commotion to the world where it belongs, and I find my inner peace, and the world dances. Mm-hmm. And this is evidence of who I really, really, really am. The indwelling deity reality that we are never moved. Aristotle said, God is the unmoved mover of the world. Well, you get in your car, get hold of the wheel, and see, first of all, you notice the driver doesn't have a head. If you had a video camera here, and when people want to sell you a car, frequently they show it like this, a headless driver, his feet on the controls and the hands on the wheel, and there I'm a headless driver, and the whole scene is moving through me. And so if we dare to look, we find that the one here never moved an inch. who you really, really, really are. Has never moved here. That's another example.
So let's talk about the little book of life and death. And what is this death stuff all about? If we're immortal and full of this grandeur of the universe.
Yes. Well, the one I see in the mirror, Barbara, is dying. He's been dying for 83 years, hasn't he? I mean, he gets older every time I look in the mirror. And that is my death certificate. That is the one who is dying. And what we do is to bring that one from the mirror, where he belongs, you see, turn him around and put him here. And this is a kind of suicide, really. He belongs there in the mirror, over there in other people. If I take that picture in the mirror and try and bring it here, it disappears, but I bring it here. To find my face again, I have to put it out there. Well, when I look here, there's clarity, there's space, there's nothing here to perish. Nothing here to perish. So it is a case of coming home and seeing there's nothing here to perish. Simple as that. Who I am is imperishable. The shelf life of the chap out there, what is it? Short. The shelf life of the one here is infinite. It is not biodegradable, is it?
So what do you talk about in the book of little book of life and death? What kind?
I talk about that. The point is, where is death? Where is life and where is death? And put it like this: everything perishes. Everything perishes. I mean, atoms perish, particles perish, people perish, even stars, planets, galaxies perish. Everything perishes. As it has birth and death. Galaxies last a long time, particles, very little time. But everything perishes. Am I a thing here? No. I'm not a thing here. Here's no thing, therefore it is imperishable. And I look here, I find no thing to perish. Simple as that. And this agrees so much with what, for instance, Paul said. Or he asked the question, O death, where is your sting? Yes. O grave, where is your victory? Well, there. We now answer their apostle, death is there and not here. So death cannot get to me. This place is free of everything. Visibly, Barbara, empty, open, speckless. Therefore, it cannot perish because nothing that perish. And this again agrees with the teaching of all the great religions, which says that who really, really are at center is the imperishable origin of the world, not a product of the world.
Yes. Can we track with you from that young man who was having a hard time of it and beginning the journey of discovering these things? And maybe if you yes. talk a little bit about your journey early on and how you developed these concepts, the understanding of the lies and beginning to put the truth of the world back into place.
Well, I happened to notice, and it's very surprising, that where I was open to the world. I happened to be walking in the Himalayas at the time, but that was nothing to do with it, really. I just happened to notice, looking up my body, I saw my legs, you see, there, and my hands and arms and my chest and so on, and everything came to a stop here. See, and above my shoulders, on my shoulders, let's say, was a whole scene. And I was at large. I was the scene, I was the Himalayas, I was Everest and all that, and I was full of that scene. And there's nothing here in the way. I'm not saying I don't have a head. Of course I have a head. Of course I have brains and all that stuff and eyes and so on. But I don't have them here. I have them over there in your camera, in other people, in my mirror. They're there. And here is the absence of all that.
Yes.
And this is, after all, deeply traditional. I mean, you take Tennyson. He says, nearer is he. He's talking about God, you see.
Mm.
Nearer is he than breathing, closer than hands and feet. In the Quran, Muhammad says, Allah is nearer to me than my own neck bone.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's it. And Eckhart, great Christian philosopher and mystic of the 13th, 14th century, preached a sermon, a delightfully brief sermon. God's in, I'm out. God's in, I'm out.
God's in, I'm out.
God's in, I'm out. And that's the whole thing. I mean, God is nearer to me than Douglas is, you see. I mean, Douglas is around. Douglas is important to me. And, you know, it only is. And, I mean, it's what I give to other people or what I inflict on other people, you see. But who I really, really am here, visibly, is this one. And I mean, this is common not only to the great religions, but to, I think, the great poets of the world. Well, Tennyson, for a start.
Mm.
Perhaps not the greatest. What about Shakespeare? Shakespeare is onto this, absolutely. In Measure for Measure, he's got the lines like this, which you will remember. Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, most ignorant of what is most assured, his glassy essence, like an angry ape, plays such tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep. So what Shakespeare's saying is, Barbara, that we have a choice. You know, we either perceive what is so evident, what is so untrue, our glassy essence, this space here, either we perceive that, enjoy that, and live from that, or we're in terrible danger of behaving like angry apes.
Mm.
Now that's strong stuff, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sounds appropriate. When you were in the Himalayas, did you have any other experiences that helped to contribute to this?
No, I think this is so radical, nothing will compete with it. I mean, this is the heart of that, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, everything else flows from that.
Mm.
But I do say this, that having seen this curious thing, you know, being headless, what should I say, enjoy that and live from that and all the other things come. And, you see, also I found, which is rather interesting, I found that I could share this with nobody. People either thought I was extremely profound and mystical and symbolical and impenetrable, or they thought I was just raving mad, you see. And so I failed to share this with people. And for 18 years, I never was sure I shared it with anybody. But I did, in the middle of that time, have a very comforting thing, because I discovered the early Zen masters of the 8th and 9th century in China. And they were saying that the whole art of life, they called it enlightenment, a word I hate, but still, they called it Satori or enlightenment. The whole art of life and the trouble, the cure of our troubles and the answer to our problems, is to see our true face. And this is called our original face.
Yes.
Well, I say I have two faces. The acquired one in the mirror and the original one here. And the original one is the face of God or the Buddha, nature, or whatever is the true face we have, which is infinite, imperishable, perfect capacity for what is given. Now, the one in the mirror is the acquired face. And that's the one we put here illegitimately, because, in fact, it belongs there, not here. And when we're very little, Barbara, you see, we haven't been taken for a ride. We haven't been conned. We haven't come under the influence of language and so forth. Mm. And every mum, you know, some dads know that the one in the mirror there is for a little child, a baby, a friend, never oneself. A long process of indoctrination. And you get the kid, and must do, because to join the club, this is what necessary. You get the kid to agree, that's my face. Mm. It's not natural, it's a required thing. Mm. And when we're very, very little, we're honest, you see. Huh. We're busted wide open. It's the charm of children, is that they're busted wide open for the world.
Well, seeing is an acquired thing, isn't it? Period. Seeing, understanding the world through sight. We learn that, don't we?
Oh, yes, we do. But I'm talking about something which is so basic. Are we coming from a thing which is perishing, limited, small, decaying, aging thing, solid, opaque, small, and very, very brief, come on, or are we coming from the imperishable capacity to contain the world?
So what happens to this awareness of the imperishable capacity after the perishable part dissolves?
Well, it's really not quite a proper question, if I may say so, because it is timeless, you see, and after and before don't quite apply, and where we're coming from is timeless, and where there's no thing, there's no change, and where there's no change, there's no way of registering time, and where there's no way of registering time, why, hey-ho, there's no time. Anyway, I have a little experiment here, you see, which I do, and people think it's idiotic, but I find it very true. You see, I look at the time now, or I look at the time in this studio here, and it's 7:40 in Carmel, or in Monterey, whichever it is, and it's 7:40. And in England now, where I've come from, it's another time. In Tokyo, it's another time. Each place has got its own time. Well, what's the time here? Right where I am, this side of the microphone. What's the time? Right here, no distance from me. And I've got my watch here, and it says the time out there, a couple of feet away, no, a foot away, is 7:39. And I bring my watch up, you know, gradually, and gosh, an inch away, I'm not sure what it is. And a half an inch, even the watch is paying. And at no distance, there's no time to register. So, you see, who you really, really, really are, this one never moved, Barbara. She or he, God, I excuse the term, I like that term. He is who you really, really, really are, and he never moved, and he has no boundaries. He is speckless, and he is faceless, and he contains the whole world, and this is where you're coming from, and it is absolutely timeless.
Most of us, I think, worry about, well, when the perishable part is no longer contained in the form that we so preferred, what happens to memory, and what happens to this continuity that we feel that we would like to call Douglas or Barbara or Jeff?
Yes. Well, Emily Bronte wrote a rather famous and splendid poem called Last Lines. And she said a true thing, I think, that when suns and universes cease to be, every existent will exist in thee. In other words, in the timeless is a kind of a freezer, you know, which prevents things from perishing, you see. It contains perishable things. And Barbara, you see, the content of the timeless one will never recover from containing Barbara. William Douglas. Yeah. You're established there in the timeless. And I'd say I'm not professing to understand this. And presently, I shall know more about it from direct experience.
We're talking with Douglas Harding on KAZU 90.3. This is Discovery. So we've gone through the little book of life and death and on having no head, and we started with your novel that's not published yet, The Trial of the Man Who Said He Was God. Let's talk about head-off stress. And the world's full of stress,
yes.
Probably because we're still believing all these lies.
Well, I think that is so partly, Barbara. But I think the situation is this, that things are built on stress, they run on stress, like cars run on gas. I mean, things are held together by stress. Stress is a good thing there because it holds things together and prevents them falling apart. It's what is stress but a system of complementary pressures, forces, isn't it?
Mm. And
the whole world runs on stress. And it's a good thing and a necessary thing. Yeah. The world is a stress system.
Mm.
What we do is to get out there, imagine ourselves out there, involved in that stress world. And, of course, we take on stress and it gives us a hard time. Because we are not essentially who we really, really are is not only not out there subject to stress, but is absolutely and totally free of stress where we are at the center. And the one you're really looking out of, Barbara, at this time is unstressable. So if you want to be hot, you go to the equator. If you want to be cool, you go to the North Pole. And if you want to be unstressed, you come home to the place you've never left because there's nothing there to be stressed. Simple as that. And it's a case of coming home to the place you've never left, the place you're looking out of, and seeing there's nothing there to be stressed. And you come home on any ticket. Any ticket home's a good ticket. And I can point to this place, and we shall be doing some experiments like that in our workshop here, or in Santa Cruz, rather. And we can point to this place we're looking out of. We can see when we put on our glasses, there are two lenses, we put on our glasses and we see we're looking not out of two peepholes in a meatball, we're looking out of one enormous frameless window. And not in our own direct experience out of two little peepholes. Well, that's coming home from the stress world to the world where there's nothing to be stressed. So if you want to be free of stress, go where there isn't any. And that's right where you are.
Hmm. Let's talk a little more about what people will be experiencing in the workshop. What is a workshop with Douglas Harding?
Well, one of the things I say is don't believe the thing I'm saying. You're the authority. You see, we're suffering, all of us, from indoctrination, from being grievously intimidated, and we allow people to tell us what it's like where we are. Nobody is in a position to tell you what you're like where you are. You're the authority. So in a workshop I say, don't believe a thing I say, test it, because you're the authority on who you are. And this workshop is about who you really, really are. And I say who you really, really are is unbelievably blessed, splendid, perfect. And the answer to all your problems is who you really, really are. And so we get together in a workshop to do sundry experiments, quite a lot of them, for coming home to the place we never left and finding this blessing, this energy, this freedom which is there for free where we are. And the workshop normally consists, I suppose, of three or four sections. An introductory spiel, rather long lines that we're doing here, see? Then the experiments, which are the nitty-gritty, they are what count. The words are kind of froth. The experiments are what count. So the first thing is a spiel, saying why we're getting together. The second thing are the experiments, all of them bringing us home to this infinitely neglected treasure in space where we're coming from. And the third part is everyone sees this. I don't allow anybody not to see it. It's so obvious, isn't it? And we make the experiments don't give you a chance. You've got to see it. I mean, everybody gets the point, just as you do. I mean, immediately you've got the point. So in a workshop, everybody get the point. Now, what they do with it is another matter. So we go on then to look at how we live this, which is a great point, is a great thing. It's not much use seeing it and then putting it on one side among all the other amusing things we've encountered. The workshop addresses the practicality of this and how we keep it alive. And we have questions also. And I think around that time, towards the end, we get on to what for me is really a crucial matter, and that is a case of confidence. What horse am I backing in my life? Mm. Am I backing Douglas, who's a loser? Come on, he's a loser. I mean, dying? He's been dying for 83 years? He's a loser? I'm not distressed about that, because, I mean, it's his nature. He's not a winner. And insofar as I trust him, the things go wrong. But when I trust who I really, really, really am, where I'm coming from, my true nature, my Buddha nature, or the indwelling Holy Spirit, or Kingdom of Heaven, or God, or whatever you like to call this, which I really, really am, if I give up my trust, give up my self-confidence in that little guy, and rely on this one, I find I'm taken care of, and that things work out. I don't get what I want, but I get what I need. And so that's what the workshop's about.
Of course, it's as you say, a simple thing
obvious
to say, but it's obvious in many ways. But it's not so easy for people to do. Why is it so hard for people to hear what you're saying, or hear what other sages say about this, or what their neighbor says about it? And why is it so difficult for people to implement it? Why does it take many, many years to begin to...
Well, it doesn't it doesn't take any time to see it, does it? It's a piece of cake. It's the most obvious thing in the whole world. We don't know what obviousness is until we see this. It's absolutely obvious. All we've got to do is turn our attention around 180 degrees from what we're looking at to what we're looking out of. So it's absolutely obvious. And to establish it, we keep coming back. Mm-hmm. Every time you come back to the place you never left and dissolve the hallucinated block here, which is hallucination, every time you do that, it's easier, you see. Mm-hmm. It's easier every time. So it's a matter of practice. Mm-hmm. And that work has to be done. Yes, work has to be done. And with some people, I think it can result and fairly soon in being centered. So you're not out to lunch. You are really with yourself. You're centered. Because the normal human condition is to be out to lunch.
Why is the normal human condition to be out to lunch?
Well, because you're in a kind of coma. We're out there, eccentric, looking into ourselves and wondering what other people see. I'm seeing and donating, building up here the image of something here. And I'm not... the normal human condition. Oh, when we're very little, we're centered, and all animals are centered. They're living from their space. But when we, as we grow up and join the human club, we're out to lunch. We must join the human club, very important. But the price is too high, the subscription is too high, and I withdraw my subscription. And what we are asked to do when we belong to the human club is to survey ourselves from about a meter away through other people's eyes. Well, you can't do that. And what I'm on about is looking at yourself from where you are and looking at where you're coming from, seeing what you're looking out of as well as what you're looking at.
Well, if all of this is at the heart of all the great religious traditions, what happened? Why aren't the religious traditions giving us this insight as clearly as you're giving it?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think, though it's at the heart of the great religions, I think religion becomes contaminated in a thousand ways. And the truth, the initial truth on which the thing was built, the original vision of this gets overlaid by churchianity, by priests, by the interest, the power trip that each religion does develop, really, power over people. And the life and the heart of the great religions is that there are kind of heretics like Douglas who go back to the beginning and look at things as they were originally. And in my view, Christ, Jesus, was onto this absolutely. I mean, he talked about a man who looks upon himself only from outside and not also within, makes himself small. Well, how big are you? And I say, if you really look and see who you are worldwide. Mm-hmm. You are worldwide. Mm-hmm. And we make ourselves small, Barbara, we get shrunk in the wash. And, you know, when we're very little infants, we look kind of small, don't we? About 2 feet long, really very tiny. But you think an infant for itself is tiny? The infant for itself has got no boundaries, for sure.
That's true.
And then when we join the club, we shrink from being a worldwide into being a little thing. Now, is it wonder, any wonder, that young people become antisocial and angry and rebellious? Is it any wonder when overnight they got shrunk from being all things to being just what they look like from outside? So what I'm on about, you know, the whole thing is, I'm not what I look like. I'm not here at 0 inches, what I look like at 100 inches. I'm not only unlike that, but I'm the exact opposite. Mm. So I tell you, you're getting what Douglas looks like, I've got what Douglas is, and they're totally different.
Mm.
And the great human nonsense is to say, I am here, what I look like to you over there, which is absolute rubbish, isn't it?
Yes, quite. What's interesting to me, though, is that we're willing to shrink, and yet some of us, like you, are unwilling to shrink.
Yes.
And what is the difference? Why are most of us willing to go along with this shrinking process, and every once in a while somebody says, no, I won't do this?
Well, I think it's a mystery, and I don't know the answer. But I think it's connected with the whole origin of the world and of evil and so on. I think, you know, probably the best light we can get on this is to think of, this is like a kind of myth, is to think of God, Buddha nature, reality, with no world, just perfect. God is there for millions and millions of eons and ages, just revolving the circle of his own perfections. He's absolutely perfect. Nothing ever happened. And after billions and billions of years, he got bored, or she got bored. And what she did was to say, I'm going to do a terribly difficult thing. I'm going to do a very risky thing. I'm going to pretend to be three people, Barbara and Jeff and Douglas, plus a few more. You see, I'm going to pretend to be these different people. And the result of that was that in order to get the whole thing set up, you have to have this illusion thing going so that people think they're separate from God and their origin. And so God set up the thing playing a game of playing hide-and-seek, you see, with ourselves.
Yeah.
And this is part of God's plan, that we pretend that we are solid lumps and we are what we look like. And I say that the great fun of life and the object of life is to come off that and tell the truth. You say, why aren't many more people on to this? And that I don't know. Well, I'm doing my best to encourage people. I'm doing my little best to encourage people to not only look at this, but share it with others. It's very easily shareable, as we have seen, isn't
it? Yes, quite. Who are the most exciting people that you've spent time with in your wonderful 83 years?
Well, I think everybody is valued to me and teaches me. Oh, I've got many, many teachers and gurus. You and Jeff and everybody teaches me. I'm so refreshed by my friends. But perhaps one of the most notable ones I haven't met Well, I've had some few friends. I'm not going name-dropping now. But I've had some pretty marvellous friends, and still have. But I think one of the most impressive was Nanda Moy Ma in Bengal, in India, who had a vast, vast following of people in North India. And she was onto this, a most beautiful woman.
Yes, somebody was just talking about her last night to me.
Really?
Yes, describe her.
She's a very, very beautiful woman, and we shared this thing together when I went to see her in India. I think she's one of the most remarkable people I've known. But I share it with, the people I share it with, like you now, it's as though one has known those people forever and ever. Mm-hmm. Because, look, the barriers are down, Barbara, aren't they? I mean, when I see who I am, well, look now, I have your face, which you've given me out of your generous heart. You've given me your face, which you don't have, and I have it. I'm looking after it and treasuring it. That's a wonderful thing to do, to give me your face. Now, what about what's behind that face? What about the consciousness, which is the essence of Barbara? Now, will I find that by peeking now into your eyes? I won't. There are no two little hobgoblins of consciousness behind your pupils. But if I want to find the awareness, which is Barbara, that essence, that indwelling Godhood, Godhead, I look here. And what I see here, the space, the capacity, is it has no laundry marks of Douglas on it, you see. And or Barbara or Jeff. It will do for you, and it will do for everyone. And it's infinite as I look here now. I mean, here it is. It goes on and on forever and ever and ever. And it has no personal marks on it. And it is awake, boundless, real, and where we're all coming from. So I now say to you, there's a double intimacy, if you don't mind my saying so. It is, I have your face. I have your appearance there, for which God be praised, and I am your reality. So have your appearance over there, and here I am your reality. Now that is so different from the confrontation story in the world. So here we are face to face, head-on collision, confrontation. You've never confronted anyone in your life. This thing we are built, Barbara, for, busted wide open for each other, aren't we? It's really marvellous. And when we start telling the truth of who we are, the world is full of blessing.
Yes. You don't like the word enlightenment. Why?
Well, I mean, because, you know, partly because it's made into such a inaccessible, mysterious thing. I say that we're all living from our enlightenment. And here we are, fully established in our enlightenment. Mm. All we've got to do is not to achieve it, but turn round and acknowledge it. Mm. And we build up this absurd picture of something which can only be attained by folding your legs into a granny knot for 20 years or I don't know what. All sorts of things, you see. No, I say that we don't know what obviousness is until we see who we really are.
Hmm. What about, you mentioned the word evil. What is evil? Well, why do we perceive evil, and what is that all about?
Well, I think evil is the name we give to alienation, separation. And evil is failure to be open. Evil is turning your back on the world. You see, here, who I really, really am here is naked and open and exposed to the world. And the little guy in the mirror, Douglas, he turned his back on the world. Now, he must do, but if that's the whole story, that is evil. Because what he says is, keep out. You can see my little chap in the mirror, get around whom my ego, image and personality is constellated around that little guy. Well, he is by himself evil in the sense that he says, keep out. I'm just announcing myself. I'm shutting the world out because I'm a thing and I'm looking after my thing and I turn my back on the world. I've got enough troubles of my own, thank you very much. But the one here, who I really, really am, which is about a meter away from the one in the mirror, the one I really, really am here is open, to the world, busted wide open to the world, naked and taking on the world's joy and suffering. You see, I think one of the reasons why we resist this, Barbara, is we really do say, I've got enough problems of my own. I don't want to be busted wide open like
yes.
this.
Yes, I think that's true, and maybe we should talk about that. What about suffering? Suffering. In fact, somebody was talking to me the other day about this. He said, "If I open up, and am available to myself and the world, I'll be receiving all that suffering and pain." That is something we consider. And maybe you've hit it on the head there. That our willingness to be shrunk comes from our unwillingness to be in what we perceive close contact to this suffering that's beyond us.
That's beautifully put. Yes. You see, I really think that the answer to my anguish is not to separate it from the world and see who I really, really am means to take on the suffering of the world. And in Christianity, this is a very powerful ingredient of that faith. And in Buddhism, you know, wisdom without compassion is a bird with one wing. And compassion, which is feeling others suffering, mm-hmm. is essential to wisdom, inseparable from wisdom. And I think the way I should put it is that coming from who I really, really am, I am naked and open to the suffering of the world, and then can go beyond it to what lies back of the suffering, the one here who doesn't separate himself from any of the suffering in the world, and to take it on and acknowledge it is, I think, to find an incredible peace and joy underneath it somehow.
Yes, but that journey through to that is such a terrifying one.
Well, yes, but I think it's even more terrifying, Barbara, if you're in your own little box there, having your personal suffering, which you think of the world has chosen you for some really nasty stuff, and there you are full of resentment and suffering your own thing, and no way out at all.
Yes.
And I think the way out is to allow yourself to be invaded by the suffering of others. And then your heart will... You see, I talk about losing your head, you see. And when I'm talking about literally one is headless. But when one loses one's head and busted wide open, instead of this meatball which closed me up, then I find my center of gravity, in fact, does move down. Mm. And I lose my head and I find my heart.
Yeah,
I find my heart, and one does find that one of necessity feels, it's not one doesn't set it up, but I think one does find that the hurt of the world is one's own hurt.
But that's vast and deep, isn't it?
Yes, and I think our blessing lies in that direction.
Oh, can you talk about your own entry into that vast, deep place of suffering?
Well, I don't think one enters into it to take on suffering. I think I don't like suffering any more than anyone else does, and I don't want to suffer any more than I need. But what I do, what I need to do, is to be truthful and come home to who I really am. And when I see who I really am, which I do now, this clarity, this openness, this exposure to the world, this being full of you and the scene now, when I see that, I think I take care of the whole thing, suffering and all. And I don't need to do two, three, or four things.
Yeah.
See who I am and then address the suffering of the world. I think seeing who I am embraces all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you see who you are, you will find this happening naturally. Compassion will be awakened.
Hmm. What's the importance of sacrifice? The traditions speak of sacrifice.
Well, you see, I think we should not be too gloomy about this, because it's really our natural condition. We are sacrificed one for another. Look, the only way I can have your face now is to disappear as Douglas, isn't it? And this is death. Douglas dies and is resurrected as Barbara. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? And we give our lives for one another, Barbara. Yes. This is incredibly beautiful. And on all this gloomy sacrifice business is a bind. I think it is something which is so blessed that I give my life for you. You know, who was it said? Paul, I think. Greater love hath no man than this, to give his life for his friend. Well, we give our lives for one another. I give my life for Barbara, not because I'm a nice old thing, but because I'm just truthful, and I'm seeing that I am disappearing in your favor. Well, that is sacrificing, Douglas, sacrificing a little guy who is perishing for the great one who can never perish. So what? Sacrifice? I mean, it's gain, isn't it? My gosh.
Yes, interesting.
The ultimate gain.
Douglas, of the traditions that you've studied, which ones seem closest to you, to this heart? Which of the traditions seem to have less of this crust of inappropriate stuff attached to them? Is it the Zen Buddhist tradition, perhaps?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think that I would say that having been brought up in Christian faith and for many years been, all my early years were deeply in that faith. It's in my blood. I can't deny it. I can't put that on one side for any other faith. But I think that going deeply, deeply into the heart of Christianity, I find that many, many insights are shared between that faith and the other faiths. And each, moreover, it seems to me that each faith has a unique contribution to make. So I owe a great deal to Zen and Zen Buddhism. I know only slightly less, I think, to Hinduism. So recent masters like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta. And I owe a very great deal to Sufism, and particularly Jalaluddin. Yes, I suppose I'm rather ecumenical, but I think the thing is, one can make a mistake of window shopping and going around saying I don't belong to any of them, because they've all got something true to say. And that means you tend not to go deeply into any one of them. And for me, I think it just sticks with me that, and I suppose this is more a gut reaction or early conditioning, for me it sticks, this realization is basic to me, that the reality behind the universe is none other than self-giving love. And it's shown in what I was saying. We are built, all of us, built to this Christ pattern, give our lives for one another, and we vanish in favor of the one there. And it's so beautiful, Barbara. It moves my heart and excites my mind, and the vision of this sings, really.
Let's talk about Jalaluddin's view of this. He was the one in the Sufi tradition that we think of when the word beloved is used. That great connection with what we're talking
That's
about.
Right.
Maybe you'd care to say some words about him.
Yes, I can give you one or two quotes from him. He says, dissolve yourself into nothingness. Become nothingness, nothingness, nothingness. He talks a lot about losing your head.
Yes.
Dissolving your head into nothingness. He talks a lot about that. And he talks about coming from... become vision, vision, vision. Become vision. And
what did he mean by that?
Become vision. Well, what is looking out of here is vision itself. Vision itself. It is the awake receiver, of the whole world. So he says, lose your head. Oh, he's a great deal about headlessness he's got. He says, heads go rolling like the game in like the ball in polo. Heads go rolling like the ball in polo. And he says, seeing into your clarity or nothingness is the whole thing.
Hmm. Did you have a chance to meet Ramana Maharshi?
No, I never did. I was in India when he was alive, but I never met him. But I regard him as having said, he's a great influence in my life. And what he said were about three things which I would absolutely dig. First of all, he said, although he didn't put it quite as neatly as this, he said, the answer to your problem, whatever it might be, is to see who has the problem. That's one. And the second thing he said, it's easier to see who you are, that is to become enlightened. It's easier to see who you are and see a than to see a gooseberry in the palm of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing I can't think of for the moment, but those will do, won't they?
Yes, those are two good ones.
They will do. And the answer to your problem is to see who has the problem. And the vision of who you are is the most obvious and accessible thing in the world. Oh, the pity, the pity. And everybody around him said, only you can do it, Master. And they put him on a pedestal so high they couldn't hear a word he said.
Mm.
So
that,
sad.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
It happens a lot. It happened very much in his case. I have visited his ashram, and people there, they say, they don't, you know, they can't see this. And if I go there and say it's the most obvious thing in the world, look at what your master said, I should probably get my mark.
They chase you out, huh?
I think they would. I think they would a bit. Although I've contributed a great deal to their journal, Mountain Path, but I only did it by quoting him all the time, which is, he says, it's available and it's obvious and it's the answer to your problem. And there we are.
Hmm. Douglas, would you give us a kind of retrospective on? Well, I won't use the word retrospective. Let's shift it around about the future of this species who's having a hard time in this shrunken state. How do you feel we're progressing in the last part of the 20th century, or not progressing, as the case may be?
Going back, well, you see, I think it's a very fascinating story. And the story began, was it a million years ago or 5 million, when a very smart ape with a very nice hand for grasping things and a big forebrain and so forth, when he became human. And the way he became human was he saw his face in the water, he saw that specter there, and the spectre invaded him. He rushed up his arm and invaded him and parasitized him here. So he took that thing, which belongs there in the water, or the mirror, which he probably didn't have, and came here, and he became he took on what belongs there a yard away, and he became shrunk, and he joined the human club. Now, 5 million years is quite a long time to play that game. It is a game, and it's produced. Gosh, what do you think of what it's produced, including all the equipment in front of me now at this time?
Mm.
I mean, it's produced language and everything else. So it was a very important game. But, well, gosh, I think it's a game with 5 million years or a million years is long enough. I mean, and I think we should now play a different game. And for the last 2,500 years, there have been people who have been playing a different game and who see what the Ramana Maharshi and I and others are pointing out. And I think the chance, the opportunity now of the human race, given these communications, given our dire need, given the experiments which we are able to share with people, because they are a breakthrough, Barbara. They are a breakthrough, making us so directly perceptible. Given all those things, I think there's a sporting chance that we shall make it. I don't mean that the whole everyone shall be, quote, headless, unquote, but that this could become the cutting, the vision of the cutting edge of our race, a sufficient number leaders or people who are setting the tone and so on should see this. And I think there is a chance. Because, after all, we've come through ages of stagnation, ice ages. We're a very versatile, very tough species. And I do think there's a chance. Anyway, I'm doing my best to see. And I think that it's time we played a new game. And confrontation is the name of the old game. Mm. And it doesn't work, and it takes you to hell.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Douglas Harding. Oh my goodness, we've come to very close to the end of our program. Time goes fast, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
People say 90 minutes, that's an awful long time to talk, and then it just goes by like that. Gosh, I wanted to ask you about modern psychology, but I don't think we have enough time to do that. Do you have any
quickies on that?
A quickie on psychology?
Well, I mean, of course, it's a very impressive achievement, isn't it? And I mean, Freud and Jung and all that tribe, I mean, saying all sorts of incredibly valuable things. But you see, if I think, if I imagine that that's going to cure my heart's anguish, I'm mistaken. Psychology is a rainforest in which you can lose yourself immediately. And I mean, you never come out, and you go, and you know, it's an endless thing, one thing leading to another. Even Freud himself talked about analysis, interminable or terminable, and it is not the cure. I mean, psychology is for polishing up that little guy in the mirror, Douglas, and he's a pretty hopeless case to polish. You see, he won't take a polish really, and who I really am is upstream of psychology and its metaphysics, if you wish. And I think that when you come from who you are and see who you are and what should I say, tell the truth, submit to the evidence, have the humility to submit to the evidence, then I think it is the best thing you can do for your psychology. And then when you look into why shouldn't you look into psychological methods and processes, you can award marks for those who got it right, or at least didn't get it right, but they didn't stand in the way of this vision.
How about science?
Well, yes, of course. You see, this is absolutely agreeable to modern science. I mean, look, when you go up to a thing, you lose it, don't you? I don't care what you take. You go up to any darn thing and you like, a book, a person, a hand, anything, whatever, you lose it. Now, I go all the way up to myself. I told you about, you know, taking pictures on the way up here.
You get down to the subatomic particles and they disappear.
That's right. And here, in this place I'm pointing at, which is what you perceive as Douglas's top knot or meatball, here I find no thing whatever. And this is scientifically verifiable because I say, come and see. In other words, to put it more generally, what I am is a function of the distance or range of the observer. Now, looked at from where you are, I am perceived to be a man. Looked at from much further away, I disappear into the Monterey Peninsula and America and the Earth and the solar system and the galaxy. Or coming nearer, I am perceived to be why a nose and then tissues and cells and molecules and atoms and so on. So what I am is relative to the view, the position of the viewer. Now, I view myself from zero centimeters, and where I am is where this wonderful indwelling Godhead resides, and it is no thing, imperishable consciousness, awake and real reality, and where I'm coming from, and the source of all inspiration and energy. And we get so tired when we get so tired hallucinating something here to block it out with.
Yes. Well, I've got to say goodbye to you, Douglas, and I don't want to. I'd like to continue this for another hour or so, but I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on Discovery, and thank you, Jeff, for coming and bringing Douglas, and thank you, Douglas.
Thank you, Barbara. It's very special to be interviewed by someone with whom I immediately shared what I had to share.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.